And now a conversation about the challenges facing international students at colleges and universities in Maryland and beyond. International students need an F-1 visa to study in the United States. The State Department reports that it issued 12,653 fewer F-1 visas in May of this year than they did in May of 2024. It's never been particularly easy to obtain a student visa, but the Trump administration's enmity towards foreign students has made the possibility of securing and retaining one considerably more difficult than it's been in the past. So what does this mean for these students, the institutions that they want to attend, and the communities in which they live and study? My first guest today is Karen Fisher. She's a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She also writes the Latitudes newsletter, which covers global education news, and she joins me on Zoom from San Francisco. Karen, welcome. Good to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Can you give me an idea of the kind of scope of the issue that we're talking about? How many international students, generally speaking, are currently attending U.S. colleges, and how does that stack up comparatively to, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago?
There's a little over a million international students, and that has basically held steady. It's actually been growing since the pandemic, as you might imagine. Many international students could not come to the U.S. during COVID-19. But I think the concern is that there are many headwinds, both political, as you've mentioned, but also a number of other kinds of issues that are sort of circulating, economic, cultural, demographic, that could affect international students. And so I think we're in a very uncertain time about those enrollments.
I understand there's little news today. NBC News and others are reporting that the State Department has begun an investigation into Harvard University's use of international visas. This is a brand new story. Have you had a chance to look at all into it? Can you tell us what's going on?
Yes. So the State Department sent a letter to Harvard this morning asking for a lot of information about international visitors to the campus, scholars, some students, researchers who come to the university. This is really, we don't know why. They said they're looking into the compliance by the university with this program's rules. But this is just the latest in a standoff between Harvard and the Trump administration. And in a number of ways, those have directly involved international students and the university's ability to enroll them.
Harvard has become kind of the poster child for the administration's international students, efforts. As I mentioned, they've showed great enmity towards having any international students come. They are trying to prohibit Harvard from admitting any international students. Have they singled Harvard out in that regard? Are they trying to do that at any other institution across the country at the moment, to your knowledge?
Well, I think what we wonder is Harvard sort of a test case? On one hand, yes, there is in particular a sort of standoff between Harvard and the Trump administration. However, when the administration said that it was looking into Harvard's international students, it explicitly said, we're also maybe looking at other universities. And when it tried to earlier this spring, stop Harvard from enrolling international students, it also signaled that it might be willing to use colleges, participation in the student visa system, and it might be willing to investigate that and give it more scrutiny elsewhere. The University of Chicago just the other day reported in some bond issuance filings that they'd gotten a query from the Trump administration. It's not yet a full-on investigation, but they disclosed it and said that they were concerned that it, you know, might materially affect their ability to enroll international students. And I think about a third of Chicago's students are international. So I think quite a few, and I hear from many universities that are closely watching Harvard, wondering, you know, is this potentially sort of the canary in the coal mine for the rest of us?
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Karen Fisher. She covers higher education for the Chronicle of Higher Education. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question or comment, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So, Karen, there was a lawsuit brought against Harvard in, or against the government, I guess. Harvard brought it in Boston. A federal judge has heard a case that the arguments were given in that case on Monday, I believe. Where does that stand? Are we, I guess we're awaiting a decision from the judge in that case. What's in front of her right now? What is she faced with deciding?
I mean, that case is principally about the Trump administration's efforts to withdraw or to suspend federal funding, scientific grants to the university. And as their reasoning behind that, they say that they have pushed Harvard to comply with anti-Semitism, crackdown on anti-Semitism, and making several other changes to the way the university runs and giving much more oversight to the Trump administration that includes these student visa issues. And so that, I think the judge on Monday seemed a little skeptical about the government's claims and, you know, why it was perhaps targeting these other parts of what Harvard does that don't seem, you know, immediately related to the underlying concerns that the Trump administration says it has. But that is, of course, just one of many issues or many fronts on this sort of issue right now involving both Harvard and universities generally and their international student bodies.
When it comes to getting visas for if you're an international student requesting a visa, for a time, the State Department, I guess, halted even scheduling interviews for student visas. You wrote about this at the beginning of last month in June. What did that halt mean for the timetable of students hoping to enroll in colleges and universities this coming fall? I understand that the ban or the halting of the interviews has been stopped, so they've been restarted. But what has that done to the system? What has that done to the individuals who were, as I said, trying to get into the country to study in the fall?
Well, the freeze on student visas, which lasted more than 3 weeks, was put in place, the State Department said, so it could start a new social media vetting process specifically for international students. I think it's probably, there could possibly not be a worse time in terms of the international student calendar for this halt to have happened. It was for most of the month of June. International students, they're not like businessmen or people going on vacation who might be applying for visas all around, you know, the year. You know, international students, most students start school somewhere between August and late September. And so the vast majority of them, probably three quarters of them, apply for student visas in the summer, so between May and August. And so it was just at the height of student visa application season when this halt happened. As you said, the visas have been restarted, but I certainly hear from both colleges and students on the ground that has been very inconsistent, that it really differs from country to country, consulate to consulate. Because you had a whole 3 weeks of students not being able to get appointments, I hear from students who say, I can't get an appointment till November and classes start in September. What am I going to do? And so I think there's a lot of real uncertainty that was caused by that widespread halt that was specific to international students.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about the screening of social media sites that these students have. They are now required to make those sites public. They have to submit a list of the sites that they're on, so they have to tell the State Department, yes, I have an Instagram account or a Facebook account or whatever. Are there guidelines? Are there things that the State Department is looking for in particular? And again, this is limited only to international students. This doesn't apply to Native American, you know, American nationals who are applying to college. Do I have that right?
Right, they're asking for that information in the visa application process for students from abroad. In one hand, there has been for a number of years a little tick off box on your application for an American visa that asks you about social media. But the fact is, it was sort of just there passively. It wasn't frequently, as far as we understand, being evaluated, but the State Department last month told basically their consular officials all around the world that they need to be looking for information that is hostile to the United States or American interests, for background of political involvement that students had in their home countries. And it suggests actually that if students say they don't have social media accounts, because I think a lot of students said, well, maybe we should just delete our accounts. That the counselor officers, when doing their student visa evaluations, should sort of see that as a negative. But beyond that, we don't actually know very specifically what they're looking for, and we think there's probably a lot of discretion given from to each consular officer.
Let's talk in our last minute here about the impact of the travel ban that Mr. Trump imposed a while back. It involves 19 countries, Iran, Afghanistan, Cuba, all sorts of places, Haiti. How does that play into this very complicated story?
I think very practically on when the thing that's already happened is, as you mentioned, Iran is banned. Iran doesn't send a huge number of students, about 12 or 13,000, but they're disproportionately in graduate programs and disproportionately in STEM graduate programs. And so it's really a talent issue there. I mean, there might not be, certain computer science and engineering programs may not have the students in them without these Iranian students. The other part though I would say is that it's sort of like many things, like the Harvard's standoff, it sort of sends this message to, and so it has students, and in fact the Trump administration has said it's considering expansion of the travel ban. So I think it has a lot of students and families on edge saying, okay, will my country be next? And in fact, a number of the countries that the administration has said that it might include in the travel ban, in fact, enroll, send a lot more students to the United States. And some of them, like Nigeria and Ghana, are countries that have really been exciting markets for American colleges that they've been getting a lot more students from. And so I think there's a real concern about just sort of what is the message that both these policies and sort of the rhetoric around the policies is sending worldwide.
Karen Fisher is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Karen, thank you for your time and your terrific reporting. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
And up next, we'll discuss the local impact of international students with Ellie Wolf from our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, I'll speak with Baltimore City Council member Mark Conway. He heads the council's Public Safety Committee. We'll talk about police accountability and public safety as it relates to the city's aging infrastructure. They had a big hearing about that just yesterday. And Jaywin Russick will report from her very full day at the Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And if you've just joined us today, we're discussing the struggles currently facing international students here in Baltimore and throughout the country. In the 2023-24 school year, U.S. colleges and universities had 1.1 million international students. University of Maryland, for example, had more than 6,000. Johns Hopkins had more than 10,000 foreign students. Those numbers declined significantly during this past academic year. Ellie Wolf is a higher education reporter for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. She recently wrote about the impact that international students have on Baltimore and its economy, and she joins me here in Studio A. It's good to see you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a big deal. If we lose a lot of international students here in Baltimore, there's a significant effect on the economy of the city. Give us a 30,000 foot view.
Well, it's important to say that it's not just an economic impact, right? It's a cultural impact. There's an educational impact on these colleges. But looking at the economic impact is a good way to assess the real numbers involved here and to get real data. So the Association of International Educators, which is a nonpartisan group, they've estimated that Maryland could stand to lose about $1 billion in its economy. International students support over 10,000 jobs statewide. And that'll impact the state on top of other issues with federal workers from the Trump administration. So this could have a really devastating impact, especially on local businesses that are around colleges and universities who often rely on international students, whether it's eating at restaurants, shopping, buying things for their dorm rooms, etc.
Yeah, you interviewed a man that owns an Indian restaurant in Charles Village, which is right near Hopkins. There are a lot of Indian students at Johns Hopkins, as we mentioned. You know, there's some 10,000 foreign students at Hopkins, not all Indian, but many Indian students there. And he was really concerned about the viability of his establishment moving forward if there are suddenly many fewer Indian students.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that surprised me about reporting this story was how open and honest some of these business owners were with us, saying, you know, we're going to close in the next year or 2 years if international students stop coming to Baltimore. It shows how many restaurants, many businesses really come to rely on that income. And we can see that, you know, in the next couple years, if more and more regulations occur from the Trump administration, and international students stop coming to the country to study and to Baltimore and to Maryland, we could see a lot more closed businesses and empty storefronts.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Ellie Wolf. She covers higher education for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. If you own a business here in Baltimore and you think it'll be affected in particular by a paucity of international students, give us a call. Our number is 410-662-8780. We'd love to hear your perspective. Our email, midday at WIPR.org. So, Ellie, one of the things that you make clear in your really great reporting on this is that international students often pay a different level of tuition than nationalized Americans pay. Why is that?
So oftentimes colleges have really started to rely on international students because they pay full freight tuition. So only 10% of the over 10,000 international students at Johns Hopkins, for example, are on financial aid. That means that 90% pay over about $90,000 a year to Hopkins. That's a really big driver of income for Hopkins. And this has been a nationwide issue. There are very, very few colleges in the country that are need blind when it comes to international admissions. So the vast majority of international students pay full freight. It's quite expensive, and schools like Hopkins that are also losing federally funded research dollars now are seeing potentially impacts to this other great stream of income that they're very used to, which is international students. So it's quite devastating.
Yeah, and you know, down the line, the impact there could easily affect native-born American students, because if the scholarship money that has been designated for American nationals is going to be under pressure because there's less tuition coming in from some of the international students, could make those scholarships more difficult to get.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about the last 6 months that has really shown me is that all of these individual income streams at colleges and universities are really connected. And a college getting grants cut and having less international students enrolled, that impacts everything. That impacts jobs and staff positions. That impacts scholarships given to Maryland students, given to American students. So it really is a fine line right now that they're trying to balance.
More than a third of Maryland's roughly 24,000 international students this year were from China. So the State Department has in particular aggressively revoked visas, and I'm using that term because it comes from the State Department, which promised that they were going to aggressively revoke visas from Chinese students in particular. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the State Department, as you said, has been quite aggressive. They've actually called out the University of Maryland, College Park specifically. We reported a few months ago that a Congressional Committee on China Relations requested a plethora of data from the University of Maryland about Chinese-born students. And so we don't know the effect yet. And like the previous guest was saying, this is a really awful time for this to be happening because we're at peak enrollment season. So colleges have not yet released their enrollment numbers. We really don't know what those are going to look like. But Chinese students really are the biggest category of international students. And with increased scrutiny, it could be really detrimental to universities.
Yeah, and there are some schools that, as you mentioned, just have a really high percentage of Chinese students. Mm-hmm. I know MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art, has a number of Chinese students. And so it's going to affect certain places even more than others. And it's going to be pretty significant as your reporting shows. Well, thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Ellie Wolf reports on higher education for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. And up next, I'm going to speak with three women in the international student community at the University of Baltimore about how the changes to immigration policies are affecting them and their institution. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the challenges that international students are facing as the Trump administration makes a concerted effort to discourage undergraduate and graduate students from attending American universities and colleges. My next guest is Kara Kaufman. She's the principal designated school official. They call it the PDSO at the University of Baltimore. And in her position, she administers the F-1 visa program. She joins me here in Studio A. Kara, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by two international students at University of Baltimore. Sabrina Pereira is from India. She graduated from UB last spring, and she also served as the president of the International Students Association. She's entering the UB Law School in the fall. Sabrina, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And Jessica Bacin is from Italy. She's a rising senior at the University of Baltimore. We've been delighted to have Jessica serve as an intern here at Midday for the past several months. Good to see you, Jess.
Thank you, Tom.
And as listeners, if you have a question or a comment about the status and the challenges faced by international students, our number here at Midday is 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. So give us a buzz. Drop us a line. So, Kara Kaufman, tell us what you do in a normal day. What is your job and your interaction with the international students at UB?
Sure. So on an average day, I probably talk to about three or four international students. Some of them are sitting right here, and we have close to 80 international students. Some of those are on OPT, and we can get to that. But
what's OPT?
Optional practical training. So these are students that have graduated, but a lot of our students actually do their optional practical training right here in Maryland. So they stick around, and they still come to us when they need advice. So
let's talk about the visa process. Mm-hmm. Obviously, individual students have to apply for a visa in their home country to come to the United States and study. Yeah. What is your role in that visa, that F-1 visa process?
So our students go through the admission process like anybody else. They get admitted to University of Baltimore, and then they come to our office, and they need to submit certain documents to us in order for us to issue what is called a Form I-20. And that is an official form that they take to their visa consular abroad. to apply for their F1 visa, and it gets granted by the U.S. State Department, hopefully.
Yeah, so you coordinate that then, you know, once the visa's, you know, applied for, et cetera. And Sabrina, in your case, you come from a country, India, that has a lot of graduate students, in particular here in the United States. What was your experience when you first applied for a visa? I mean, you graduated, you just graduated, so you've been here a few years. Tell us how that went.
Yeah, I applied 4 years ago. I actually went to a community college first. So it was the same process. I was issued an I-20, and I still remember going to a different state, standing in a long line, and waiting to be interviewed, hoping that I don't get my passport back, because if you get your passport back, it means you're rejected. So in a line full of people who are getting their passports back, I just had to pray and go in there, do the interview, and it was like an advantage for me because I've been in the United States as a tourist before, so I've already seen the country. I never overstayed my visa, so I had a lot of green flags. And yeah, my visa was approved when so many people got rejections that day. And I came here. I've been here ever since, graduated from community college, came to University of Baltimore, and just graduated.
Yeah, and about to jump into law school.
Yep.
Huh? Well, my condolences on that. That's good. And Jessica Betjean, did you have a particular strategy, you know, in mind when you applied for your visa to come to the United States? Tell us a little bit about your story and the circumstances that brought you here.
I didn't really have a strategy in mind. Just like Sabrina, I was had some green flag, didn't overstay my visa. And
a green flag is a good thing.
Green flag is a good thing. Red flag is usually when you overstay your visa before, or if you have any criminal records or anything bad in your background. Luckily for me, everything looked fine. The only thing that came from Italy is that usually country issue visa for university for 4 years, so you have enough time to finish your degree. For me, it was a little bit different because I got it issued only 1 year. Not exactly why. I don't really know what the reason was for it. But that was my only differences, I guess. But overall, everything went fine. I just bring all the paper that they requested, and they issued the visa. And the only thing is that I had to go back each year to renew my visa, mm-hmm. which I think that's what they want to see. They want to see that I have a strong relationship with my home country, and I have no intention to stay here.
And Sabrina, how about you? Did you get a 4-year visa, or did you have to do it a year at a time?
I actually got 5 years. Mm-hmm. So my visa is still valid for another year, but I do have to go back and renew it if I have intentions to leave the country.
Mm-hmm. But of course, law school is going to take you more than a year.
Yes.
So there's an obvious timeline there. Mm-hmm. And Kara Kaufman, have you seen in the last couple of years more and more visas being rejected? I mean, can you give us a sense of what the process is now, and if it's considerably different than it was a few years ago?
It's hard for us to say, because at our university, we do have a large number of students that come from countries that traditionally have a higher rejection rate. And that tends to go country by country. It's a number of factors that go into that. It can be that the country has a large number of overstays for people from that country. It can be just individuals who are going are not maybe picking our university for the reason, like for the school, just the school, but also for family that's in the region, because we do have a lot of referrals from family members in the region. I think that leads to a higher rejection rate. One of the key things that students have to prove in a visa interview is that they have non-immigrant intent. And so when you do have a number of family members present in the United States already in permanent resident status, and or if they are citizens, it can be hard to do that, especially for somebody young, to prove that they have ties, significant ties to their home country. So that can drive the rate up.
Yeah.
Of denial.
And Sabrina Pereira, to you know, put a point on that, you basically have to convince the consulate in the U.S. consulate in your home country of India that you're going to get this degree and then leave.
Yes,
you have to basically say, I really want to come to this country to study, but gosh, I would never want to stay here and live and, you know, have a career.
That's exactly.
That just seems like at odds with rationality.
It is really hard, especially as a law major, because what's the point of having an American law degree and going back to India? So I did have to do a lot of research on international law and then convince the embassy that I want to do international law, and there was no way other than that I could come here.
Yeah, so that was a part of a strategic decision you had to make in order to get approved.
Correct.
And in this case, it worked.
Yes.
Right, yeah. And Carrie, do you have a comment you wanted to make?
I just wanted to say, and she speaks to a really good point, and you did too, Tom. In many of these students' cases, they don't know what their future plans are. I mean, who does at 18 know where, life will take you? And I do think that we've, in the international ed world, have held out hope for a while now that they will create a dual intent to the F-1 visa, that maybe somebody does have ties to their home country, but they may one day choose to stay more permanently if they get the right circumstances, a job, they meet the love of their life, they stay here and they settle, right? We want people to have a path to doing that. And so I think that would be one of the things that we've been advocating for in my field for a long time, is a switch to dual intent.
Kara Kaufman is the principal designated school official at the University of Baltimore, working with international students. Sabrina Pereira and Jessica Bachin are international students at UB. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. And of course, years ago, we had people like Tom Friedman, a columnist for the New York Times, writing essays that say, every time we hand out a PhD to a foreign student in the United States, we should include in the diploma a green card. Just stay here. We've educated you. You now are a person who has every capacity to contribute, in a really meaningful way. So again, this is just, it really is contrary to common sense, in the minds of many. So Jessica Bachin, let's talk about social media. We were talking about this a little bit at the beginning of the show with the reporter from the Chronicle of Higher Ed. Consulates are scrubbing and scrutinizing your Instagram accounts and your Facebook accounts and TikTok and stuff. What do you know about that? And how does that affect your strategy going into this process of getting your visa renewed?
Yes, Tom, that is correct. They are absolutely becoming more strict on it. When I first applied for my student visa, they asked me all the social media I had. So this process was already happening before this administration. I do believe that since January, this has become more strict. I personally have a private profile just because I do like to be more private in the social media, regardless from my visa. But also, I feel like social media has become a platform where many, many people feel free to share their opinion and their thought on it. And because of that, I think a lot of people will now kind of restrain from saying many, many things. Again, I don't think that personally would be a problem for me. They do require, though, at the moment, for you to have a public account. So that was the only differences from before, where they can see what you share. And
so that means you are obligated now to change your profile on your social media accounts from private to public. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah.
So I definitely will be able to do that. And I could do that. The only thing is that they're also looking at what you're liking and what you're commenting on, which it's... it could be a little bit tricky for some people, especially for people who have strong opinions in their political view. But who knows?
Yeah.
What can come next?
And Sabrina, has it, impeded your ability to, exercise your right of free speech, which you have a right to that, because if you're in this country, you are protected by the Constitution, regardless of where you were born. How has that affected you personally, the social media aspect of this in particular?
I think that's one of the most interesting things about the United States. I've actually traveled a lot of countries, and U.S. stood out to me because of the fact that there was free speech, especially as a woman. Obviously being in the law, you have a lot of opinions that people might not like. And I still remember coming to this country, I would talk to my relatives about America, and they would say, if you have so many things like negative to say about America, why don't you go back to India? And these were things said to me by my family. But the thing was, you know, I don't say anything negative about India because I know there's no hope. I don't see that country changing, even though I love my country. But at the same time, about America, there's so much hope. Like, I see growth in this country. I know this country can change for the better. And for that, I would say these things so that this country can change. But now I feel like we're in this environment where we're scared to say that because a negative thing doesn't mean growth anymore. It means you're bashing somebody. And that's, so it's been hard. You know, I'm trying to stay away and not say anything about this country because I truly do love this country. I mean, it has given opportunities to so many people, both immigrants and American citizens. And I think there's no country like America.
I would agree. I think there is no country like America on the upside and the downside, perhaps, in both ways. So Kara Kaufman, is the University of Baltimore doing anything in particular to, you know, respond to the current challenges of that international students are facing? Does the university, you know, actively recruit international students? You know, a few years ago, we had a mayor here, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, who was all for having immigrant families, Hispanic families, people from Central America, Mexico, move to Baltimore because the city's population continues to decline. Is the university saying, well, here's a growth opportunity for us, and how does that fit into this whole current situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think these two could speak to this as well, but I think what we're doing is to just be open. Our door is always open. We're lucky. We're a small campus. We have a very, you know, we don't have a lot of barriers to student direct contact with administrators there. And so our students know they can always walk into our office if they're feeling worried, concerned, scared, something. They see the news in the morning, they're going to be in my office, you know, by noon to come in and get some reassurance. And so really it's just being there daily to handle their concerns, to talk with them one-on-one, to reassure them and continuously give them the message that despite what they're seeing, we want them there. They are such a big strength and boon to our university. They really are. These are two of our outstanding student leaders on campus. They do a lot in our community. They are, you know, doing internships. They're leading volunteer work in the community. They're the strength of our university. And I think the city. You mentioned, you know, the Stephanie Rawlings Blake and bringing immigrants. I love that I walk down the street in Baltimore and hear multiple languages being spoken. That's a unique thing, and I don't want to lose that. So,
sure. I mean, Jessica, how would you describe the mood of, you know, the folks in the International Student Association at University of Baltimore? I mean, are people frightened? Are people afraid at this moment?
I love the community, the international student community at University of Baltimore. I honestly feel understood, and it definitely is a good place to share your thoughts and share your concern. I had heard some people being a little bit concerned more than most of that for their future, because it definitely is a big consideration to take. Also, speaking for myself as well, I do ask myself, how far can I push myself? How worth is my journey? And I do feel it's very much worth it at this point. And I fought for almost 4 years, and I'm very happy for where I got. And I do am afraid that all this hard work I've done is gonna be not worth it at some point. So I feel having an international student community is definitely an important space where you can feel, understand, and share your concern and your.
Mm-hmm. And Sabrina Pereira, is revocation of visas a real concern? I mean, is that something that's keeping you and your fellow international students up at night?
I mean, of course. And I think one of the reasons why I chose to go to UB Law is because of the fact that it is not a big campus that gets you a lot of attraction from the federal government, that's for sure. So it does keep me up at night, but I'm glad that I chose UB Law to go to because there's not been any case. as of now.
Yeah, and okay, so no one's had their visa revoked, which is great, but that has happened at some other high profile cases, Harvard in particular, Columbia, etc. Do you think there's a real dampening, or we just have to finish up? We just have 30 seconds or so. But has there been a real dampening of, any impulse that might exist to protest things like the Israeli involvement in Gaza, or, you know, any of the other issues that we've seen take hold of a lot of college campuses? Do you think that this is having a tamping down effect?
I mean, yeah, it does. It's scary, but like, you can't do anything about it. In the end, it is not your country, unfortunately. Instability is always a thing as an immigrant. So you just got to work with the law.
Sabrina Pereira is an international student in the UB Law School. Jessica Bachin is a rising senior at the University of Baltimore. She's from outside of Venice, Italy. Kara Kaufman is the principal designated school official at the University of Baltimore working with international students. Thanks to all of you. I really appreciate your perspective. It's been very enlightening. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Baltimore City Councilman Mark Conway joins us to talk about police accountability and public safety. Plus, J. Wynn Russick reviews this year's offerings at the Contemporary American Theater Festival. Fresh Air is up next. It's the tech journalist Vahini Vara. He's going to talk about a new collection of essays on search engines and AI. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Thanks for being with us. I am grateful. Have a great day.